It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it, and I find myself staying up late to catch all the action. I can't be dragging the next morning. That's why I go for a 5-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or when my favorite team is playing late. With over 15 flavors to choose from, like watermelon, tropical burst, blue raspberry, peach mango, and more, there's a flavor for everyone. On their website, you have the option to build your own 12-pack or 24-pack and have it delivered right to your door. And if you're out and about, you can always pick up a 5-hour energy shot at your local grocery or convenience store. They're everywhere. 5-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before the next tip-off.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Welcome back, folks. The federal government's January 2025 current population survey has been released, and it has some really interesting outcomes. Steve Camerota, Director of Research with the Center for Immigration Studies, joins us. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, if you could, for the benefit of a listening audience, describe the current population survey and why it's important.
So the current population survey is where we get our unemployment number and labor force participation. And then once a year, they pick up here, ask more questions. And that's where we get a lot of our income figures, poverty, health insurance coverage. So it's one of the main sources of data, really going back decades, that we have on the U.S. population. And before you ask, yes, the Census Bureau, which collects it, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which does a lot of analysis of it, both are clear that illegal immigrants are included in the data, though there's always some debate about how many get missed. But in case you're wondering, it looks like 29% of the immigrants in this data are illegal immigrants, and I can tell you how we know that, but that gives you an idea. It gives us a pretty good picture of what's going on in the country, and what it shows with regard to immigration is absolutely extraordinary.
Steve, if you don't mind, maybe I think what we're going to do, I think we have a bad connection because we're getting feedback. We're going to go to a break and we'll try and reconnect with you if that's okay with you, because a lot of the stats that you just quoted got jarbled and no one could hear what they are. So we're going to go to a break real quick, reconnect with Steve Camerota from Center for Immigration Studies. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you. From daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Take me out to the ball game.
What are you doing?
Did you know DirecTV has the most MLB games?
So, you're singing?
Yeah, they put your favorite teams front and center right when you turn it on. Buy me some cold cuts and flapjacks.
Those aren't even the words.
I'm allergic to peanuts.
Stream DirecTV, home of the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks. RSNs available with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Do you believe you were wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Steve Camerota, Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies, and the topic is the government's January 2025 current population survey that has some very interesting revelations. Let's pick up the conversation there, Steve. I apologize.
No problem. So you were asking about the data source. It's where we get the unemployment numbers and all kinds of other data. Each month they do different things with it, but the point is that that's where we get a lot of our income and poverty and health insurance coverage. So when someone says, oh, the average wage is this, or average median household income is that, it essentially comes from this survey. So the January file is one of the newest we have, and without a lot of technical explanation, it's the first file to be better adjusted to reflect the surge in illegal immigration that we've seen. The Census Bureau tries to weight the data to reflect things like that. I know it sounds a little technical. Bottom line, though, is yes, illegal immigrants are included in this data, and I can go through some more numbers, but some are missed, but the point is what the latest data show is something extraordinary. It shows America, when it comes to immigration, has never been here before.
Tell us about that. I mean, I was struck by some of the outcomes. The final tally for the Biden administration, 8.3 million new immigrants, most of them here illegally, but that reflects something even bigger about what went on during this 4 years when we look back as it relates to illegal migration.
Right. So, without, again, I don't want to get technical, but that is just the growth between January of 2021 when Biden came in and January of 2025 when he left. As you said, 8.3 million is the growth in what we call the foreign-born, or really just more generally just the immigrant population, legal and illegal, and it includes everyone, a naturalized citizen, a green card holder, a foreign student, and, say, and an illegal immigrant. And so that number total has hit 53.3 million. And again, that's 8.3 million more than it was when Biden came into office. Now, that is not the number of new immigrants who came. Far from it. The number of new immigrants who came during Biden's presidency, legally and illegally, is about 12 million. The reason that it only grows by 8.3 is actually about 1% of immigrants go home each year, and since the population is at 50 million, that's a lot of people. That's several million people. It may even be as high as 1.5% go home each year. Second, we have deaths, and deaths are not trivial either in a population of 50 million people. And so the number of people coming was a heck of a lot more than 8.3 million, but that's the net growth. And of that net growth, of 8.3 million, it looks like to us about 5.4 million, or about two-thirds of the growth, were illegal immigrants, an increase in illegal immigrants. And remember, you might say, well, gosh, didn't we, that still seems low. And it could be low, if you're one of those people who thinks that. But let me just explain one thing. Lots of illegal immigrants actually go home. There is also deaths among illegal immigrants. And this is one final point. Among illegal immigrants, many of them are legalized each year. They either get asylum, they marry an American, or they're sponsored by another family member. And we have other programs that legalize illegal immigrants, which I won't go into here. So, yeah, a lot more than 5.4 million illegal immigrants came, but like I said, it's offset by these people who leave that population either through legalization, going home, or deaths. And so, again, these numbers are picking up something extraordinary. We've never seen anything like this. Again, just so they know, the total foreign-born is 15.8 million, 15.8% of the U.S. population. It's never been that high. It's blown past the record set in 1890 and 1910. So in a very real sense, America has entered uncharted territory on immigration.
What struck me about that stat is the Census Bureau had projected that we would not reach that level of foreign-born until 2042. How could they? I mean, they just totally missed it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a government agency, so they don't move fast. So those estimates were put out in 2023 where they try to project the U.S. population forward, and it's always just an educated guess, but it was based on trends prior to Biden coming to office. So if we had had the trends the pre-Biden era, then it probably would have been closer to more accurate. They actually also, there's some other technical issues I think they got wrong there. But the bottom line is, yeah, it's rendered their population projections entirely obsolete because they didn't think we were going to get here for nearly, for like 17 more years. But it turned out that they were wrong, and the Biden pace of immigration was so vast that it completely rendered what they'd done meaningless.
And to put that in context, the 8.3 million increase in a four-year period is larger than the growth in the preceding 12 years. Now, I often talk about government aid, that, you know, it's wonderful, you know, when agencies are able or governments are able to get it, but you got to be in a position to receive it. In other words, You receive it and actually do something operationally with it that's going to be meaningful. What happens to a society that has an immigration number that is like this, so much greater than the preceding 12 years? How do you account for it? How do you handle that? And I mean, we hear the anecdotal stories across this country of the difficulties that jurisdictions are having in receiving this many immigrants at one time.
Right. Sure, I think that's a great point. The pace of immigration was so unprecedented under President Biden, and that strained social services. It probably in some localities had drove up housing costs and made things unaffordable, particularly for renters. It certainly had other large impacts on schools, and there are implications for taxpayers. We know that the immigrant influx under Biden, because it was so illegal, is less educated and poorer than was new arrivals in previously. And so that creates a lot of strain, because how much taxes you pay, putting aside whether you're paid on the books, and I should point out, the Biden administration gave out a lot of work authorizations. Whether they were following the law, in my view, they were not. But the point is, they gave a lot of illegal immigrants Social Security numbers. I know that may surprise your listeners, but in fact, they did. And so probably about 3 million work authorizations. So in the last 4 years. So a lot of illegal immigrants are paid on the books, but because we think about three-fourths of all illegal immigrants have no education beyond high school, they still don't earn very much. That means they don't pay much in taxes, and oftentimes they are eligible for certain programs, and if they have any U.S.-born children, then those children have full eligibility. So there are fiscal implications for bringing in so many less educated people. And let me be clear, employers love it, right? They're looking for someone to cut grass or to fix a roof or to be a nanny. This is great. But for the taxpayer, low-income workers are not generally a good deal. And second, The other group that takes it on the chin is less educated Americans and legal immigrants already here who face the competition.
And then you add to it this notion of remittances. I was searching for more recent data. The only thing that I could find was something going back to 2022, and the numbers are staggering of how much money they actually send back to their origin country.
Right. So this represents a kind of leakage, a kind of, because the money is not here, it's not available to stimulate our economy so that people aren't buying stuff here, and they're not generating sales tax. So it represents a kind of outflow of capital. And one of the concerns there, one of the bigger issues, is that that outflow tends to occur from lower income communities where people already don't have a lot of resources. So that's another potential problem with this massive influx.
And are there studies that have actually quantified that? I mean, you know, economic projections are always based on a dollar, a new dollar to a microeconomy turns over 7 to 9 times in the life of that dollar in that microeconomy. And a lot of the projections are based on that belief. But when you're not really accounting for all these remittances where you have, as you point out, this leakage or these outflows, it kind of disrupts the way that we look at our economies, because the data we have is, in the end, not valid.
Right. So there's a lot to be said there. The short answer to a way to think about immigration is that it creates winners and losers. The overall effect on our nearly $30 trillion economy of almost anything is relatively small compared to that number. But it can be very large in sectors. So you can have a big increase in housing prices in Springfield, Illinois, that makes it very unaffordable for people due to an influx, that kind of thing. The second thing to keep in mind is that, in general, if you want to know the economics, immigration most definitely does two things. It makes the U.S. GDP, gross domestic product, the aggregate size of our economy, bigger. You add more labor inputs, more people, more consumers, bigger economy. And that number is large. If you just this influx added hundreds of billions to the size of GDP. Because the immigrants are poor, the other things it does is lower the average GDP in the United States, which is usually one of the measures used of wealth, development, that kind of thing. So, in other words, it makes the overall pie bigger, but the average smaller. But neither of those two things actually tell us whether the native-born population or the immigrants, even already here, are better off. And there, it depends on who you are. If you're a low-wage worker in a lower-wage sector of the economy, it's bad for you. If you're a taxpayer and you've brought in a lot of unskilled workers, that's bad for you. But if you're an employer, or if you're a consumer of these goods, which, you know, lots of us are, of course, lots of us get our grass cut or our roof fixed or what have you, then you benefit. So it's a winner and loser. I think one of the main concerns with this kind of influx is that the losers often are cities and localities that are already struggling fiscally. And the losers are also less educated Americans who often have the least job prospects. And so that's one of the big concerns. It tends to come at the expense of the people who don't have a lot to begin with. And if I may, and it's an issue I discuss in the paper, the other huge problem in the U.S. labor market is all the American men who are of working age. This has nothing to do with population aging. These are people, say, 16 to 64, who are not in the labor force, which means not only do they don't work, but they don't look for jobs. And this doesn't count people in prisons. There's just a huge number of people who don't have a college degree, who are American men, who are on the economic sidelines, neither working nor looking for work, which means they don't show up as unemployed, by the way. You have to say you're looking to be unemployed. And this is a social disaster. I can't even summarize how bad the literature shows, but just keep in mind, men, when they don't work, are associated with all kinds of negative outcomes, whether it's crime and suicide or overdose deaths and political and social alienation. So it's really bad that all these guys are on the sidelines. And what immigration is doing is partly crowding these guys out, but the other thing it's doing, it's letting us ignore this problem, which has now continued to get worse decade after decade. So, I mean, it just looks terrible when we look at these guys. There should be at least 5 to 10 million more U.S.-born men in the labor force if we had the kind of labor force participation we had, well, decades ago.
Steve, I make the observation on this show frequently that we have, 40-some-odd million people living below the federally identified poverty level. There's any number of ways of looking at that and kind of interpreting that number. We don't do the greatest job ever in dealing with that and trying to get folks back into the workforce, as you just pointed out appropriately. And it's just kind of mind-numbing to me why we would believe that an economic or business model of bringing more folks that have a high likelihood of falling into that category into this country every year, and why we're not really looking into the possibility of economic credentialing to make sure that these folks are actually employable and they're filling the jobs that we really need them to fill.
Right, so there are 2 points on that. One is, let's be clear, most immigrants come to work. Of all the newly arrived immigrants, about 60% work. Because remember, in any human population, some people are caregivers and so forth. Some are too young, too old to work. Some are disabled. Some have no interest in work. So 60% isn't bad, but it reminds us that they have dependents and that, not all immigrants are workers, and it can't be that way. There's an old joke in Europe about when they started to have guest workers, and someone quipped years ago, "We asked for workers, and they sent us men." And I think that's really important to remember. Immigrants are people. They're not just labor inputs. They have children who need education. They have needs at local hospitals. They will drive on the roads. They're people. They're human beings. And so their impact on society is whatever human beings' impact is on society. They're not just a worker. That's the first point to think about. And so as best we could tell from data from a year earlier, we don't have the income data yet, it looks like 36% say of all children in America are either immigrants or they're U.S. born but have an immigrant parent who are in poverty. So child poverty, and it looks like it's probably about 37-38% now, child poverty in America is very much a phenomenon linked to immigration and with all the challenges. So that would be one example, and that's because we tolerate illegal immigration and have a legal immigration system that mainly is about either refugees and asylees, humanitarian, or it's mostly family members coming here to join someone who's already here. It's not based on your education. It's not based on your skills and potential earning. And so we get a pretty low income influx. Having said that, again, relative to other populations, immigrants do work. Even the illegal immigrants, they certainly find jobs at relatively high rates. But they tend to earn what someone with their education earns. And that's why it tends to grow the low-income population, quite a bit. It's not that the immigrants are all here with, sitting up on just sitting on the couch collecting a welfare check. Far from it. But people, if you allow in the modern American economy, a lot of people with low levels of education, you're going to really increase the size of your low-income population. There's just no way around that.
Yeah, the way that you identify these winners and losers, it's interesting because in my monologue in opening today's show, I talked about the most recent census estimates for New Orleans. We've lost population, and it wasn't as bad as it otherwise would be because of the number of immigrants, both legal and illegal, that are here. But when we're losing high wage earners and getting low income wage earners, that's not a trade-off that's positive for your local microeconomy.
Right, that can be true. Now, Louisiana is a little different. It is still a very low immigration state relative to the rest of the country. And that means that you don't get a lot. There's like a lot of immigrants there who are the small number of immigrants there tend to be things like doctors and lawyers and things.
Absolutely.
So you don't really. It's sort of America of 1970 when it comes to immigration. Relatively low numbers and relatively high skilled.
Why is that, Steve?
Well, in general, immigrants. The two things that we know best that drive immigration to locations is one, job growth, and Louisiana has lagged job growth. So you don't see a lot of immigrants in West Virginia, even though it's right next to the border. Even New Mexico does not have as many immigrants as like Texas, California, and Arizona. You don't see a lot of immigrants in Western Pennsylvania. That's where, say, Pittsburgh is. And you don't see a lot of immigrants in a state like Louisiana because it doesn't have a lot of job growth in the last few decades. I didn't say it was zero. I didn't say it was terrible. I've liked every one of my trips to your state. I'm just saying it's not a high job growth state, and that's one reason. The second thing is immigrants often go where the other immigrants have gone. Social networks often drive immigration, so it builds on itself. So even today, a huge fraction of all new immigrants end up in California. But since it doesn't have an existing large immigrant population, that means Louisiana is not going to get a lot of immigrants. It got some. It's getting more, so I don't want to tell you it's nothing by any means. The data shows it's gotten bigger, but it's still relatively low.
As always, Steve Camerata, thank you so much for joining us and providing. I loved your paper, laying it out. All of the publications that you guys put together over there are just really worthwhile reading. You can go to cis.org and find all of this data that's being reported out. And we certainly thank you for your time, your insight, and have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me again.
Thank you, sir. Steve Camerata, Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. Just when you thought you had recovered from Mardi Gras, not so fast. There's more to come, and we are the beneficiary of same. Lawrence Shahardy, co-captain of the crew of Argus, joins us. He's also one of my wine-worthy friends. A little inside joke there. Lawrence, welcome to the show.
So glad to be here, Noel. Thank you for putting me on.
Lawrence, big news. Obviously, that day, Mardi Gras Day, was pretty ugly, and I think everyone came together and figured out a way to resolve that issue, and you guys will be rolling on Sunday. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we'll be rolling Sunday at 10 a.m. on the traditional Metairie Road route ahead of the St. Patrick Parade. And we're looking forward to it. It's going to be a great day. We're bringing Mardi Gras to St. Patrick Day. So it's going to be exciting. We're expecting big crowds and looking forward to it.
The weather's supposed to be great. What can we expect from Argus? I know when you kind of, you know, try to re-engineer the parade on a different date, it's not as easy as a lot of people think, right?
No, you know, you're absolutely correct. We shut everything down once we were notified that we couldn't ride on Mardi Gras Day. And then we got a call from the parish, and they were trying to work something out to reschedule. And thanks to the parish and the St. Patrick Committee, Parade Committee, everybody agreed for us to roll this Sunday ahead of the St. Patrick Parade. But we were able to put the parade back together again. We're going to have we have marching bands. We have a few groups in the parade, and our riders are going to be on the floats. And so it'll be a traditional Argus Mardi Gras Day parade. It just won't be on Mardi Gras Day. It's going to be the day we celebrate St. Patrick's Day.
Lawrence, I had the opportunity to talk to some of the executives in the St. Patrick's Day parade, and they were very excited about the accommodation. And that was good to see that, you know, multiple crews coming together, being collaborative, and, you guys going off early that day at 10 a.m., which I think is a great start and will make for a great day. That's a process you don't always see. You've been around a long time. I've been around a long time. You don't always see that. And it's just so encouraged to hear that everything worked out.
Yeah, it is. And it's a good example of when government wants to work with people and cooperate with people to make something happen. And, of course, you know, thanks go to our parish president, Cynthia Lee Shang, and the parish council for allowing this to happen. And they worked not only to bring us in, but also to bring the St. Patrick Parade Committee in as well. So, yeah, it's really a good example of government doing something I think is good. And I think the people who come to the parade are going to really have a great time.
Now, you have been a big caretaker of Mardi Gras Day in Jefferson Parish, and the trucks weren't able to roll either. I think there were similar accommodations made for the truck parade as well on a different day. Is that true?
Yes, that's my understanding. My understanding is that the truck crew that would roll behind Argus on Mardi Gras Day is going to roll next Sunday following the Irish-Italian parade. That's my understanding.
And that would be on that traditional veterans route. So everybody is, you know, because people don't realize the financial commitment made not only the crews, but the riders as well. So when it cancels like that, it's a big loss, right?
Oh, it is a big loss. It's a monumental task, obviously, bringing everything together. But, you know, getting the floats for Mardi Gras Day or the parade day, the tractors. And what people don't think about is tractor drivers. The group of folks that drive these tractors that pull the floats, you know, it's a certain group of people, and they know what they're doing, and you really have to rely on them. So, like in Argus's case, we were discussing with the parish the possibility of rolling the Monday night before Mardi Gras, but that didn't work because of all the parades going on. We had no tractor drivers. So that was our problem and why we couldn't go to that Monday night the day before Mardi Gras. So, no, it's a monumental task putting a parade on, Mardi Gras parade on. It's a year-long process. So to take it apart and then put it back together again in 11 days is a pretty big feat.
And you know what's not talked about a lot either is you know, it's important that you have this continuity, that y'all do roll, because it is difficult and it's getting harder and harder to stage parades economically. And when you have, if you have a year that falls out, it makes the following year that much harder to put on, right?
Absolutely. I mean, insurance costs continue to go up. Cost of floats and maintaining floats is increasing, and cost of tractor drivers, you know, it's over a period of time, everything goes up and cost. And so, you know, yeah, it is a difficult thing to do, but, you know, we've managed to do it. And, you know, we're just looking forward to be able to parade.
And that just highlights what you said earlier, the importance of parish government getting involved and making sure that this happens, because they really are acting as stewards of the whole celebration of Mardi Gras in the future, working with the crews.
Well, that's very true. And you know, this is part of our culture. Mardi Gras is part of our culture. The St. Paddy's Parade is part of that culture. The Irish-Italian Parade, the same thing. And so to miss a parade, you know, because of weather, is bad enough, but it's even worse if you can't figure out a way to have that parade at a later date. And, of course, we're fortunate and lucky, and thanks to Jefferson Parish and our parish president, we're able to parade on Sunday.
Now, I understand that you guys are at Gennaro's today, joining forces with the Irish parade officials in their celebration today. Is that true?
That's a true statement. There will be some presentations and speech making at 5 o'clock this afternoon by Gennaro's right there off of Metairie Road. Well, Gennaro's is actually on Metairie Road, but I think the festivities take place on the street next door. So, yeah, we'll be there this evening and looking forward to that.
Well, have a great celebration this evening and a great roll on Sunday as well. You and your other co-captain, Rob DeVinny, with the crew of Argus, we thank y'all for all the hard work that you do in bringing Mardi Gras to Jefferson Parish.
Thank you, Newell. Appreciate the call. Appreciate you allowing me to be on with you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us, folks. So, folks, we got a statement from the Office of the Special Presidential Envoy, Steve Witkoff, and the National Security Council. You will recall that President Trump had put some deadlines on Hamas. And this statement reads as follows. President Trump has made it clear that Hamas will either release hostages immediately or pay a severe price. On Wednesday evening in Doha, U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, and National Security Council Senior Director for the Middle East and North Africa, Eric Traeger, presented a bridge proposal to extend the ceasefire beyond Ramadan and Passover and allow time to negotiate a framework for a permanent ceasefire. Under the bridge proposal, Hamas would release living hostages in exchange for prisoners in accordance with previous formulas. The Phase 1 ceasefire would be extended to enable the resumption of significant humanitarian assistance, and the U.S. would work towards a durable solution to this intractable conflict during the extended ceasefire period. Through our Qatari and Egyptian partners, Hamas was told in no uncertain terms that this bridge would have to be implemented soon, and that dual U.S.-Israeli citizen Eden Alexander would have to be released immediately. Unfortunately, Hamas has chosen to respond by publicly claiming flexibility while privately making demands that are entirely impractical without a permanent ceasefire. Hamas is making a very bad bet that time is on its side. It is not. Hamas is well aware of the deadline and should know that we will respond accordingly if that deadline passes. This is hot off the presses from the White House issued today. Obviously, not unlike what the Russian response was, it seems as though Hamas is trying to extend this out and play this out and elongate the process. And some very stern observations by Steve Witkoff and the National Security Council saying, we're not going to play with this much longer. You're either going to agree or else. We'll see. A lot of people have been waiting for the or else. And it seems as though they're trying everything that they can to try to avoid the or else. But I think at some point in time, I just don't know how willing Donald Trump's going to be to continue this verbal game that these folks are playing with the United States. You know, the one thing about issuing ultimatums is that if you don't back it up with what you said, you lose credibility. And I got to imagine that Donald Trump knows that. And I can't imagine that he likes being played. And I think that's exactly what Putin's doing. And I think that's what Hamas is doing as well. So pay attention through this weekend. There could be some things that are actually happening there. And there could be breaking news at any given point in time and moment. Steve Witkoff and part of his team was meeting with Vladimir Putin and Russian officials last evening in the hopes of trying to get to a ceasefire agreement, a 30-day ceasefire in the Russian-Ukrainian war. All right, it is free-for-all Friday. Scoot has buckled in. All ready for it. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Well, yeah, we are expecting a little turbulence during our show today. There's a new poll out that shows that 60% of Democrats agree with Gavin Newsom, California governor, when it comes to transgender athletes. They should not be competing with women. So we'll talk a little bit about that. There's some controversy about the new live-action remake of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and we'll talk about that. Also, we have a story about legislation in Texas about furries. and certain things that will not be allowed in school, for example, litter boxes. So we'll talk about that too.
Scoot's got a great lineup coming your way on Free For All Friday. Stay tuned. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday.
If you're thinking about GLP-1s for weight loss, listen up. You must make sure you're maintaining your muscle mass while you're losing weight. Otherwise, you can slow your metabolism and regain the weight. Omisid, a natural superfood protein shake, has been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. It optimizes and supercharges your metabolism so you can lose weight easily. Use Omisid with GLP-1s or as a natural alternative. Find out more and see the university studies at omised.com. That's AlmaSed.com.
Street Easy asked former New Yorkers if there's anything they miss about life in New York City.
Let me put it this way. House of the Home Theater sounds appealing. but that's until you realize you no longer have a theater district.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, Street Easy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Hey, it's Jim Costa with Cash the Ticket. Mike Valeni and I are all over the tournament again this March. Breakdowns of every region and every game, who are the Cinderellas, and which team's cutting down the nets. Subscribe and listen to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app, wherever you get your podcasts.